Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is David Greenberger. David Greenberger has been a real estate attorney for over 25 years, helping clients with thousands of transactions to buy, sell, refinance, and manage real estate. He has owned an escrow firm and is president of the 1031 Exchange Advantage, Inc., a 1031 exchange accommodator for facilitating tax-free exchanges under the IRS Section 1031 code. David's quite familiar with many of the management, tax, accounting, and transactional issues surrounding residential and investment real estate. Some of his clients include Prudential California, the largest broker in the United States, and Prudential Douglas Elliman in New York. David's articles have appeared in the New York Real Estate Journal, Lore Magazine, and Creative Real Estate Magazine. He has appeared on the cable television show Creative Real Estate Roundtable on numerous occasions. David, we welcome you to our show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be here in such a good real estate market, too.
It is a good one. And by the way, I had the pleasure of being interviewed by AD and Jackie Kessler years ago and for a few times, and it was a delight to be in front of him. And you probably didn't need this, but at the time I did. I was nervous, and I got in front of him, and it was like being interviewed by my grandfather, and I just didn't worry about anything after about 2 minutes.
Very true. Very interesting, lovely gentleman. In fact, I have an intimate knowledge because AD's son, Judd, helped him in the business, was a tremendous businessman in and of himself, and was my partner in the exchange business for many years.
Oh, I did not know that. So you're very much connected to the family.
Yeah.
It's interesting. This law, 1031 exchange, has been around since the early 1920s. So I wonder, has the intended beneficiary of the law changed? I wonder who was benefiting from the law a long time ago. It probably was a kind of a narrow group that's probably expanded beyond anybody's imagination back then.
Well, there's no question about it. And it's a great question because it really does. I don't know how long your show is, but it takes you through the history of 1031 in the 20th century, in large part on the real estate side. It started in 1918, I believe, and it was just benefiting, in that day and age, two farmers who came across each other. They lived across the way, and one of them had six black horses, the other one had six white horses, and they decided they were going to swap. And they did. And the government said, you know what, we want our tax. And they said, you know what? We're going to court. That's not a sale. That's a trade. So we don't think we should have to pay tax. Well, tax court agreed with them, and that was really the first tax-deferred exchange. It was for horses.
Well, what's interesting, you just bring up a point that probably a lot of people don't realize, is that that's personal property and not real property, but there are exchanges in both worlds.
No question about it. And they are very, very different in terms of the set of rules, much more stringent on the personal property side. The real estate property exchanges are the ones that I'm most familiar with. And that grew out of that swap. And it stayed pretty much convoluted, to finish the answer to your question, up until 1990, when people exchanged real estate, it was really more for Donald Trump, and they have a name out of the headlines today, and the people like Leona Helmsley and the people that own the really big time, expensive properties that could hire slews of attorneys to bless the transactions, because they had to be swapping like kind property, which was very hard to determine what was considered like kind, but. They would call each other up and say, okay, you got the RCA building and you got the Empire State Building. I want, what you got and you can have what I have and so forth. And it became convoluted, and so it really wasn't used by the general public at all for most of the 20th century. And then in 1990, there was a case that prompted Congress making a law to allow for an exchange, and they set up the rules how it would be done. And they made it real simple and cookie cutter, and that allowed for the general public to get involved. Unfortunately, because the real estate market in the 90s was kind of iffy,
right,
and this is your expertise, Bruce, it wasn't used very much, there wasn't much education, and then it came to pass that when it really heated up, it started to get used an awful lot, mostly on the West Coast. And then from there, people forgot about it again because the market went down, and here we are back after the boom that we had in 05, and it's starting all over again, and it's really almost to the levels. It's coming close to the levels of when it was getting very, very busy in 04, 05, 06.
Are state and federal laws in agreement, by and large?
In most of the states, they do follow the federal law. There are a couple of states that don't, and those are the unusual cases, maybe two, three states. Interestingly enough, it doesn't extend to all of the commonwealths. And so, in other words, Puerto Rico, I don't believe, is included, although the Virgin Islands has been. So it gets a little iffy with who's in and who's out, but there's only a handful that are out. It's the majority, maybe 45 to 47 states that follow the Fed.
Are the 1031 rules, as we know them, are they under scrutiny and maybe subject to some change as we are trying to chase down tax revenue?
I don't know that they're going to go as far as 1031. It's anybody's guess. They've always talked about 1031 being changed or done away with since 1918. But to be honest, the real hardcore investors in this country who've known about exchanging and have done it all these years, they don't even know what their original tax basis was. If they ever tinkered with 1031, it would basically mean nuclear winter for the real estate market. I mean, nobody would sell their property because the tax basis is so low that if people would just sell and didn't have the advantage of the exchange, the taxes would be, in some cases, more than what they'd get for the selling price.
Exactly. I don't put anything past the attempt to try to get revenue from people that have assets, but we'll see.
That's a different topic. Yeah, I certainly agree with that.
Just some of the words that are used in the 1031 exchange business. What is a qualified intermediary?
No, that's a good question. I guess that'd be me. A 1031 firm that follows the rules for the client, does the documentation, and acts as an escrow agent in some ways, holding the funds in between the sale and the purchase, is called a number of things. Most of them are nice. It's a qualified intermediary. It can also be known as a 1031 exchange firm. It can be a 1031 accommodator, a facilitator. So it's all the same thing with all these different names, and it doesn't make it easy to know why. But it's all the same. It's a 1031 exchange firm.
If I woke up tomorrow morning and said, I'd really like to do that. I'd like to be an accommodator. What would be the path for me to get approval for that?
I think, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of stringent requirements.
That's what I thought.
To be approved. And that's problematic and has been in the past with people getting in and out of the business who shouldn't be there in the first place. In terms of, beneficial to the consumer, the best accommodators are attorneys, in my mind, because they understand the law and can guide people, not only the tax law, but the real estate law and their options, and really just look at things analytically and give them their choices. So I think a person is well served that way. But whatever firm they use, they should look for a firm that has a certain security policy in place with safeguards so that their funds are safeguarded. And I can talk more about that if you're interested, but that is really the key factor to find. Whatever the size of the firm, the safeguards are the most important thing.
Yeah, I think we'll circle back around that. I want to get two more definitions in place. A relinquished property.
Relinquished property is the name given to the property that you're going to sell initially that usually begins the exchange. And I say usually because you can do exchanges the other way where you buy first, but most of the time when you sell first, that begins an exchange, and the sale property is known as the relinquished property.
And the property that ends up getting purchased is the replacement property.
The replacement property, right. And there can be more than one that you replace with.
Okay.
But the one that is sold is relinquished. The one that's bought is called replacement.
Relinquished is an interesting term. So in a 1031 exchange, who actually ends up selling the relinquished property?
Well, I mean, technically, the contract is in the name of the owner of the property, the title holder, the seller, and then by assignment, the sales contract is passed over to the accommodator in order to comply with the IRS rules.
Right.
And so then the accommodator is in a position to accept the funds at the close of title and hold them as accommodator or intermediary, if you prefer, until the client needs them to put money down on a deposit or deposits to buy one or more replacement properties.
So, I mean, the word relinquish is actually pretty accurate. The owner is relinquishing ownership to the accommodator, literally, because a net check comes to the accommodator and waits for instructions on what to buy.
Yeah, and that really is the nature of the transaction. The IRS is saying, if you're going to relinquish your rights to the funds at close and give them to David or some other trustworthy accommodator, then we'll give you a tax break.
What are your limitations on what you may and may not do with those funds?
Well, that gets back to the security issue. The law doesn't limit us very much, except that it says they must be made available to the exchanger, at time of deposit or purchase. So the law itself, and most of the exchange agreements allow for a couple of days' notice before those funds have to be available, doesn't restrict the accommodators very much. Now, there are certain states that have put in some restrictions, like California and others that have some bonding restrictions or some prudent man standard for the investments of the funds. There are not a heck of a lot of security provisions. So the best one that we've been able to find is a specialized agreement that we enter into with the client and the bank called a qualified escrow agreement. And what that does is put severe restrictions on the funds, so much so that we can't touch them without the client's signature. And that's the kind of security that you need. The bank is the policeman. The money goes into an account. The accommodator signs on it, but the bank won't move the funds without the client's signature as well.
But not every 1031 exchange company is set up like that.
Most of them are not. Even some of the larger ones that you would think are do not operate that way. And, you know, we don't have any franchise on that concept, but it certainly is a prudent way to operate. And I'd rather do it that way because everybody's got peace of mind at that point.
There's a designation, Certified Exchange Specialist. Is that common for the industry?
I think that is something that the trade group had put together. I know there's some exam requirements. I don't know how many people have that designation or how important it is, to be honest with you. But like I say, I think somebody with a legal background is probably the best designation.
Okay. Do you find that most people are members of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators,
FEA? Federation of Exchange Accommodators. A lot of them are. There are a lot of dangerous situations out there where attorneys are acting as accommodator, and they're also acting as the attorney on the transaction for either seller or buyer. That can be problematic. There's two views on it. But if the client is able to demand his money back at any time because the attorney is the fiduciary of the client, that can jeopardize an exchange, whereas the accommodator is not a fiduciary. That's why you do want to have security procedures in place. The accommodator is just going to follow the rules of the exchange agreement because that's what the IRS says he's got to do. He's not beholden to a client, which is what can impact the credibility of the exchange.
Well, let's start playing within a transaction, because all of these examples that we're about to talk about are real decisions that investors have to make and sometimes don't know that there's any ramifications for making them. So let's say that as the original owner of the property, of the relinquished property, what happens if I direct escrow through an amendment that says that I would like some of the cash of the sale to go directly to me? Number one, is that allowed? And if it is, what are the consequences of getting that money?
That is an excellent question and very timely because of what's happened in California. It typically was done all the time in a very, kind of cavalier, carefree way. So an investor would ask for the money. The escrow would send the investor what he wanted, would do the withholding that California requires on those funds, but then they were free to take it and then settle up with California and the federal government when they did their taxes. What happened was there was a case in California. The Franchise Tax Board got involved and said, no, you can't just cavalierly ask for what you want. The amount of cash boot, which is what it's called, that you're taking has to be written into the exchange agreement and initialed by all the parties. And if it's not, not only are you going to owe taxes on the money you're taking, your whole exchange is invalidated.
Wow.
So we changed our documents, obviously, when that case came down. But people still don't pay enough attention to that. And it's usually not the best idea to take cash that way. It's better to take it out by way of a loan when you buy the replacement property. But if they want the cash, they have to write it into the agreement.
Okay. Let's say that I own a rental property free and clear. Can I buy and use the net funds plus financing to move up in asset value? So I sell something worth $200, but decide to buy something that's going to sell for $400, use my $200, and then borrow $200 to get a bigger asset. Is that
sure?
That's allowed?
Sure. Yeah, no problem. I mean, we try to do even exchanges if possible, but there's no real detriment to you buying more property. Certainly your taxes are not going to be affected negatively. You'd owe no taxes. You're just buying more real estate than you need, and your tax basis is going to be increased because you bought a more expensive property, but you start with the low tax basis and you add the adjustment.
Selling a property in California and going to other states, probably sometimes the real estate you're buying is less expensive, so you can you can buy more than one property with the exchange money.
Yes, you can buy multiple properties as long as they're all purchased within 180 days, which starts running when you close your sale, relinquish property, and you can also use funds to improve one or more of the properties that you purchase. So it's not only for purchasing real estate; it's for improving real estate during the exchange. The improvements all have to be done within the exchange period. But it's a great way to build out your property with tax-free money.
Okay, when you say improvements, are you talking about from ground-up construction even?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did a very large improvement exchange where the guy had been building on land for 3 years under a contract. Someone else owned the land. He was building on it for years. And then we set up the improvement exchange when he had his exchange in place. And I actually reimbursed him for all of the improvements he'd put on that land during the prior 3 years.
Okay. If I have financing on a rental property to be exchanged, so let's say I have a $200,000 sale and I have a $100,000 loan, what happens if I just use the net cash that comes from the relinquished property to buy a less expensive asset and own it free and clear and I don't borrow money?
Well, that's permissible, but you are going to pay a prorated tax based on how far down you're purchasing. So buying down is similar to cashing out, and they charge tax for that. So if you go too far down, you know, you eat up all the gain that you had, really. You know, the exchange isn't really worth very much. If you're going down 10-15%, you had a 30% gain, you know, you're still to the good. So you're paying half the tax and saving half the tax. But, you know, you want to know your numbers because otherwise you might be in a situation where doing the exchange isn't even of any value to you.
Does boot come into play there?
Yes. That's what it is.
That's what it is. So if
boot, when you either get cash or you buy down.
Is there Is there a special tax category for boot, or is it just depends on the situation and each individual property?
Well, you know, the calculation is based on every individual property, but, you know, the concept is whatever you have to use all the cash that's in your sale and buy same or greater. If you break either one of those rules, you're going to be paying the tax rate based on however much you break those rules.
Okay.
They want you to replicate your situation, meaning if you had $1 million building, whether you had a $100,000 mortgage or all cash, they want you to buy another $1 million worth of real estate, one or more, or one or more plus improvements. So they want to keep the real estate market going by you reinvesting, similar to what you came out of.
Okay. After the close of my relinquished property, I've got 45 days to locate a replacement property.
Mm-hmm.
How many properties can I nominate?
Well, it's three parts to the rule. The third part is so complicated, I just make believe it doesn't exist. But if you ask me again, I could tell you, although I wouldn't advise you to even consider it. But the first part of the rule says three. One, two, three. That's real simple. You can list one, two, or three properties, buy whatever you want. You don't buy anything, then you have a failed exchange. So there's the three-property part of the rule. The second part of the rule is called 200%. And so what that says is whatever the value of what you sold, so if you sold $1 million sale property, relinquished property, you can identify two times or 200% or $2 million. So $1 million relinquished, you can identify $2 million worth of real estate. So that could be one building for $2 million, or that could be five buildings at $400,000 a building, or however many it adds up to. But the total value of what you can identify, see, the value is used there. So 200% of what you sold can be identified. Two times what you sold, easy way to think of it.
Okay.
So that's second part of the rule. Now, I'm not telling you the third unless you ask me again.
Well, we have sophisticated people, so we've got a couple minutes left in this segment. I know it's convoluted. I kind of read it and shook my head. So
it's really a government rule. It's kind of like they don't want you to even think about it. But the bottom line, because you got to understand, the bottom line is you can identify whatever you want, 100 million properties. It doesn't matter. But the caveat is you have to buy 95% of the value of what you identify. So that means you could be in a situation where if you identify $1 billion worth of real estate, you have to purchase $950 million. And if your properties that you're buying are worth $949 million, you might have to go buy another property just to get over to the 95% of what you identified. So it really can mess you up because you got to buy more than you might have even wanted to, or your whole exchange is invalidated. It's a real roulette game.
Okay. So obviously most people fall in the three property or the 200% rule.
Three or two, correct.
Okay.
And that's the best way to do it.
And I never realized that the business could be cyclical. So you're saying that when downtimes happen, 1031 exchanges are not nearly as prevalent as when we have equity grow and people deciding.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because the benefit is on gain, and if there's no gain, nobody needs an exchange. The only thing that's going to be exchanged is things that were bought hundreds of years ago or exchanged so many years in a row that the tax basis is so low. But of course, you know, there's not much gain. It's usually a slower market, so the percentage of transactions is down. We're the last person to find out that the real estate market is back, and I'm happy to tell you it is.
Okay. What would be a way for people to go to your website and find out about your company?
That's great. We have a brand new website, and it's got a lot of cool functions and features. It's at www.my1031place.com. So it's www.my1031place.com.
All right. Thank you for joining us, and we will we'll be back in our next segment.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.